First item we discussed was the SSC and its composition and the opportunity to nominate people for the SSC. The SSC itself is going to discuss and forward nominations up to the executive committee, but I'd also like the council members to put some thought into it as well. If they know a particular person with a particular set of qualifications that you think would benefit our SSC, I ask you to forward those to the council office prior to the November council meeting. We also had a discussion on a policy on correspondence from the council. And we also talked about public testimony. Take the first item. In terms of correspondence, official correspondence policy, enclosure 1 in your in document 6 behind tab 1 is a draft policy that we'll need a motion on. It talks about how the council corresponds publicly and officially. Essentially, those correspondents need to come under my signature or the chair's signature and the executive director's signature only. And there's a policy here for you to review, and also hopefully we'll have a motion this morning so we can put that into our SOPs. We also had a discussion about public testimony. And as many of you know, we received a request from an organization to broadcast or rather air public video testimony. And the executive committee had a long discussion about that, and we're not taking a policy, making a policy decision at this point or recommending one to the council. I think most of you or all of you should have received an email with a link to that video testimony, and we will continue to provide that to organizations or individuals that want to link up council members with something they posted online. But we don't think it's appropriate to tie up council time at this table. We're so busy with video testimony, especially since there's no opportunity for the council to question the individual giving the testimony, and the testimony may not be germane because things may have changed since the testimony was recorded. Again, it's more detail in the document about our discussion. We also quickly discussed the possibility that the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission and its new, I don't know if it's an addenda or amendment to dogfish, may consider state-by-state allocations. It's November meeting, and we may have a possible response to the whatever decision the ASMFC makes at our November meeting, which is a week or two after the commission's meeting. We discussed U.S.-Canada agreement issues. You know, the possibility that there be ongoing work to create a legislative fix to our U.S.-Canada agreement. We also talked about some discussions that the TMGC had at its most recent meeting concerning the possibility that the two nations may engage in trading of quota on an annual basis. There was just a discussion that the TMGC had, and the executive committee suggested that the Groundfish Committee and Groundfish Advisory Panel take up that discussion when it has time. We discussed timelines and management actions. You'll see enclosure 2 lists the updated timelines. Our 11:30 agenda item is herring today. The executive committee spent time discussing herring and has recommended to the council that Amendment 5 has deficiencies which need to be addressed prior to the council putting the document out to the public for comment. So we'll get more into that later on today for the rest of the day. We reviewed a letter that the North Pacific Fishery Management Council had sent to Eric Schwab concerning funding for observer coverage and monitoring. That's enclosure 3. I just brought it to the executive committee's attention, and it's included here if you want to look at it. But things are heating up in terms of scrapping for dollars, precious dollars that are available to pull off some of the monitoring needs across the nation. We discussed the scallop RSA, and I believe a letter did go out from Paul Howard to the Science Center, so we're awaiting a response there. Recent monkfish assessment. It's clear that we're going to need to initiate another framework to incorporate the new information that we received in the assessment. So there's a recommendation there from the executive committee to do that. With the final meeting occurring at our January council meeting for that framework. And Terry Stockwell presented an outreach straw man for the next amendment, which is slated to be a catch shares amendment with monkfish. He'll discuss in greater detail with the council some of the discussions and meetings that have gone on since then. We reviewed a recommendation from the Joint Groundfish and Scallop Committee to suspend that joint committee and to take all items that were being debated by that committee and forward them to the respective species APs and committees for further development consideration. We discussed SASE, the habitat model, SASE, and are currently investigating a peer review for SASE. Council staff is coordinating with the Science Center and the SSC to schedule a peer review. We can talk more about that. We just briefly touched on NROC and BOMER. Is that how you say that, BOMER? With respect to marine spatial planning. And finally, the service told, or Pat Kirkle told the executive committee that we're going to need to initiate an action in groundfish that needs to be implemented prior to May of 2012 to address the prohibited species, the ocean pout and the window pane and such, so that we put accountability measures in on those stocks. Any questions? Sally McGee.
Are you entertaining questions on anything from your report at this time? A question then on public testimony and the video testimony that was submitted. I'm wondering if, and this is really kind of a signal of a change in ways that the council might be receiving input. And I know, although I haven't seen it for myself, that the Mid-Atlantic is doing webcasting. I don't know if there was any discussion that the committee had or might have in the future about just ways to open the doors more and give people, especially those who I understand from the video testimony, are either it's a long way for them to travel, it's cost prohibitive, it's too much of an impact on their businesses, just giving people other ways to participate other than the traditional ways. And you know, maybe something from the Mid that that they're learning through their advances in technology can help us along. But was there any other discussion that you had on that?
Yeah, I mean, just on the specific issue of webcasting, either in November or January, we're going to start that. I think we reported that out at the last council meeting from the previous executive committee meeting, just working on the technology side of things in our shop, but we intend to do that. I think the concept is to have two cameras or one camera with a wide angle of the discussion table with audio, and then the screen will be split on the user side so that if there's anything that goes up on the board, they'll be able to see the motions or presentations. As far as a broader overall communications plan, I know staff, the executive committee met with the staff or with Paul Howard and Pat and a few others, and we're working on a communications plan, which I hope to bring to the executive committee. Chris?
John, we may be a little bit behind in testing out the video portion because we understand the Mid-Atlantic Council's had some trouble with the video streaming, so we've still got to search around for a workable technology, and the South Atlantic has had some problems with video streaming, but you know, we're working on it.
Jimmy?
But I just want to make it clear, I think it's my understanding that that's a one-way stream. It's not input from testimony from other people on video, so I think that should be stated.
Right. Mary Beth?
Thank you. The North Pacific also had issues with the video part, and they seem to have dropped that. And even though, and I have used it several times, I've also used the MID, and I think it's quite helpful, so I'm glad that we're moving in that direction. But there is some, you can, usually the staff person that monitors it, and if you have an issue, you can email them. You know, well, it's not email, but you can contact them. It's not the same as testifying. It's not that kind of a communication, but there is a little bit of back and forth. So if somebody couldn't find a document or was, you know, if it has staff support, there is some two-way contact. Communication.
Yeah, Jim, it is intended to be one way for people not at the meeting to at least experience what's being discussed. But if you'd like, we can set up a Twitter account for you and you can... Okay. Anything further for the Executive Committee report? Dr. Pierce?
Yeah, John, the draft correspondence from the council, would you clarify, is that a revision of an existing policy that was enacted back in the late 1990s? Is it brand new? I don't recall what you said.
Yeah, we've never had a written policy on this issue.
Okay, well, I'm glad it exists. I think I'm the person who prompted the establishment of this policy in light of the fact that as chair of the Scarlet Committee, I had two letters on behalf of the committee sent to Council Gene Martin requesting some information, requesting his views, legal views on some outstanding issues related to Amendment 15, specific needs for clarification, just to make sure that those clarifications wouldn't put the council in a difficult situation relative to public comment, not having enough public comment. In addition, at the public hearings, there were concerns raised about National Standard Number 5 as applied to Amendment 15, so I thought it would be useful to have Gene weigh in on that. After the letters were sent off, Paul very correctly corresponded with me and indicated that it should have been done in a formal way, letter under your signature. So thank you for that clarification. It will prove to be useful for the future.
Rip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are you entertaining motions concerning this at this point?
I am.
I would like to make a motion that the council accept the draft policy concerning correspondence from the council as the official policy.
Is there a second? Seconded by Doug Grout. Discussion. Seeing none, ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Unanimous. Anything further for the Executive Committee report? Mary Beth?
Yes, I just noted that you included this correspondence to Eric Schwab from the North Pacific Council, which I think is helpful for people to read, and I would encourage everyone to do so. I was there in June when they had their discussion about this item, and they will be taking final action on it in their October meeting. But the sentiment certainly in that region, they're undertaking a major change to their observer program in the Gulf of Alaska, so they're trying to cover smaller vessels and more fisheries, so it is a significant increase in coverage that they're looking at. And they are very concerned when they look around the nation at the funds that New England has received in particular to support our monitoring program. And they're struggling with ways to have industry supporting part of the program, small boat issues, all things that we've discussed. But I think it is important for people to read the letter, and I just wanted to note that.
Couldn't agree more. That's why I made sure it was included. Anything further? Okay, moving on, Executive Director report.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Little admin measure. The hotel is going to have a deli buffet available for anyone, $15 per person at lunchtime. Let me see. Also, at Executive Committee, we discussed skates a little bit. We had received some written correspondence and also some verbal discussions, telephone calls about skates and the reduced trip limit. As you note, skates is not on the agenda, so however, I did have staff prepare some fact sheets and include the correspondence in your binder. In the event that the public brings up skates and asks the council for action or future meetings or anything, you do have that background material that you should have read over the last 10 days so that you're very up to speed on the skate issues. And so it's in your binder, information material on skates. There are three task force going on now dealing with marine spatial planning. There's one in Rhode Island dealing with an array of buoys and also energy. There's one in Maine and one in Massachusetts, all dealing with marine spatial planning. I've been trying to become a member of those task forces. However, you know, there's just too many task forces coming up. Stillwagon Bank also is going to be dealing with some marine spatial planning issues, and I just want to express my concern that we have this executive order that's talking about coordinating all marine spatial planning, yet everyone is doing it on their own. And one of the main reasons why we have this executive order to look at things holistically is so there can be a regional plan on priorities and what the councils and fishermen and the public should be concerned about. And yet we've got the Department of, or the Bureau of Oceans Energy Management Regulation and Enforcement, which used to be MMS, and we changed the name. Hopefully they'll do a better job. But anyway, I want you to know that it's highly unlikely that we'll be attending every task force, and we're going to concentrate on this new regional body that is about to, I think, be recognized as the regional coordinating body called NROC. And I've been invited to attend a meeting November 9th and 10th. The council chairman and our council staff, I asked the Ocean Policy Task Force that was instrumental in establishing this Ocean Policy Executive Order, that the councils be officially recognized and by law have a seat at the table for these regional bodies. The executive order did not include councils or state fisheries at the table. Nevertheless, if NROC, I've asked them to include us as members, and I hope to get an answer from them on November 9th and 10th, but it's absolutely essential that fishing be at the table to deal with the trade-offs of energy and data collecting and fishing. So I'll keep you posted on that. Also, in a recent conversation with NIMS headquarters, the National Sanctuary Program will be going out shortly asking its members and the public to identify additional sanctuaries in their region. So we will be watching that very closely as well. Rodney and I will be attending a National Transportation Safety Board Fishing Vessel Safety Forum in October 13th and 14th. The NRCC meets October 27th and 28th. We'll be discussing priorities and the resource necessary to do priorities for 2011. I ask that we will have an executive committee meeting November 1st to discuss priorities for the overall council as well. So if you have any ideas for what you want to see addressed in 2011, make sure you get that input into me, and I'll work with the executive committee. And the administrator for fisheries, Eric Schwab, will be here late this afternoon, and he will be attending our meeting Wednesday morning, and he'll address the council for an hour from 8:30 to 9:30. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Questions for Paul? Dave Preble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I share your dismay, as I think most of the industry does, with the way the marine spatial planning process is proceeding. We did take this up yesterday at the Habitat Committee meeting, in particular, the Pioneer Array issue. Everybody feels like they were blindsided by that proposal. They finally extended the time to comment to the 30th of September. The council was never informed, at least I was never informed, that this project even was in the works. The project, by their own EA, they decided that they had a fancy on the effect on habitat, which may or may not be true. We have no way of knowing since we weren't included in any of the planning. But even if they do have zero or very little habitat effect, there was never any consideration given to the effect of the Pioneer Array on fishing and fisheries. And I would submit that given where this array is being put in place, an extraordinarily productive area in an area that several major fisheries concentrate on, that this will have a considerable effect on the fisheries, considerable negative effect, mainly through the displacement of effort into places where catch per unit effort would be much lower. So we discussed it yesterday, and it's the wish of the Habitat Committee that the council develop a strongly worded letter protesting this kind of treatment and non-inclusion in a process that will have a great deal to do with the fisheries that we do manage.
So we will, you know, unless there's objection from the council, it's my intent to draft a letter for that comment period saying that we feel we should have been included a little bit more in the discussion of the siting and or the supposed impacts. Okay, Dr. Pierce.
Yes, since you brought it up, Paul, on the skate fact sheet, on the discard estimate, on the back of the fact sheet where it says 2009 discard mortality estimated revised specifications for Amendment 3 were 49.6 million pounds. I read that so that I'm going to conclude that there was discard mortalities of about 49.6 million pounds. Total discards must have been about 100 million pounds because the discard mortality rate is 50%. That's the B, but that can't possibly be. We didn't have a discard of 100 million pounds. So I just have to need to know whether there's just a misunderstanding that. Is it worded incorrectly? And then if it is 49.6 million pounds of dead discards, then how do I reconcile that with the front part of the page where it says 35.4 million pounds of dead discards? So just seeking to check that fact sheet. Okay.
We'll let Andy get into the details.
Yeah, those figures are, in fact, accurate. The 2009 discards were estimated in total using SBRM methodology, and then the 50% discard mortality rate applied to result in the 49 million pounds.
Okay, so in 2009, we had dead discards of 49.6 million pounds. That's right. Okay. Yep. And for 2010, the specifications were assuming that the dead discards went down to 35.4 million pounds.
We applied a 2007 to 2009 discard mortality average. That's the assumption. And the discard rate in 2009 was actually higher than the other 2 years. So that coupled with that applied to the total TAC or ACT actually resulted in, you know, essentially the assumption that discards would have to be 29% lower to at least keep the catch below the catch target. There's still some flexibility in the 25% uncertainty if that doesn't occur.
Mary Beth?
Thank you. I just wanted to go back to Paul's discussion about the task forces, the different ones that are happening. And I was just curious how you're learning about their agendas, their meeting times. Are they corresponding with the council sending information?
They're not, and they believe we are. They don't know we're FACA exempt. So all these meetings are federal employees or state employees, and no public, because they think we're public and FACA would apply if the Bureau of Energy had a meeting. You know, there's FACA concerns. So anyway, but I get word of these meetings from Chris Volke from NIMS Habitat section, and he's been trying to get us members of these task forces, and the group is concerned about FACA.
Well, I'm not sure I understand all that, but I guess those are the ones where the minerals people have now become the ocean energy people, so those are not public meetings. And then they're not, okay. And then the NROC, that is a public process or not?
I think it is, but under the new executive order, it will be. But right now, they have not been the executive order has been signed. It talks about regional governance, but I'm not so sure NROC has been officially assigned as the regional body, because the National Ocean Council has not met yet to start establishing a governance structure.
And then the recent Federal Register notice, I mean, wouldn't they have to go through that process of applying to be that regional entity and then seek funding? I'm not sure how all these pieces come together. But I guess the point, if the NROC process is a public process and you get them to agree to send you the agenda or something, if you could just share it with us. I mean, maybe with all of our driving up and down the coast, maybe we'll actually make one of the meetings at some point.
Yeah, the whole idea is that we become a full voting member of NROC, and then you'll be absolutely in tune with everything going on.
David?
Yeah, my question is for Paul. Given the fact that now an executive order has been issued and we've been kind of left on the cutting room floor, what is our next step? You know, clearly a letter writing campaign doesn't seem to be very effective here. How do we get people like the council, the AFMFC? I mean, we represent the commercial and recreational fisheries of this country. How do we get into this process in a meaningful way?
We have a conference call, I think it's once a month, with Eric Schwab, the AA, and we just had one last week, and we expressed our dismay that we were not included by regulation as part of these regional governance bodies. And he said, basically, that doesn't shut the door completely. You can go to these bodies and ask them to become a member. So I've sent them a letter. John and I have sent them a letter. They've welcomed us to the first meeting. Okay, it's in November. And at that point, I'm going to say, okay, I want to be a full voting member of this body and then go from there. But even if we're not a full voting member, the council will attend every one of those meetings as the regional governance structure for marine spatial planning.
Okay, thank you.
Rick Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and congratulations to you and your officers on the results of the election. It's good to be with you today. This regional ocean planning issue, I think, is a very big one for the councils. Corporately, I think we can say it's fair to say that we're disappointed in the result of the executive order in that the councils don't have the seat at the table that we had argued for collectively. And yet, I think as we come into this transitional period, I think there are still opportunities for us to try to advance the council's interest in the regional planning process. And we had a presentation by Sam Rauch at our meeting on the policy and potential next steps. His advice was that we work closely with these regional, with the existing regional governors groups to try to get their support up to CEQ and the National Ocean Council for council integration into the process. Right now, the way the policy is written, the councils would have a consultative role in the process, but it's not specified, it's not clearly defined. And with respect to that point, as we begin to interact with these regional bodies that currently exist, there will inevitably be some sort of transitional period because the National Ocean Council has not yet formally established the regional planning bodies, and it's not clear exactly how the existing structures are going to relate to the new regional planning bodies because they'll have federal co-leads once they're established. Organizationally, they'll be different than they are today. But the challenge for us in the Mid is that the existing governance group is MARCO, and they're already moving forward with the development of the products that will ultimately feed into the regional ocean plan. And so it's in our interest, at least regionally, to be involved with them now as they begin to develop those initial products that will feed into the broader regional plan. And so I made a presentation about a month to the executive board of MARCO looking for opportunities to integrate the council in the process, and they're receptive to that. They're going to come make a presentation to us at our October meeting, and I'm hoping to formalize some sort of relationship and participation on their working groups or their executive body between the council and MARCO, recognizing that MARCO will eventually have to transition into that regional planning body, but it's in our interest to be engaged now. And I'm hopeful that we can work at the regional level to put together some sort of models that could then be offered up to the NOC as examples of how the council can be integrated with these regional planning bodies, because ultimately there will be a regional ocean plan written for the Mid-Atlantic and for the Northeast region, and the councils have a lot to offer both in terms of identifying human uses of the ocean and also fisheries resources and related habitat resources that are important to conserve and protect. So I think we have a lot to offer in the process, and we need to continue to advance that interest despite the outcome of the national policy. I think we still have an opportunity during this transitional period to advance the council's interest.
Sally.
Yeah, question. So for the November 9th and 10th meeting, is the intent then to have both staff and a council member, either the chair or some representative, attend? I think that would be a good idea to have, in addition to staff, to have a member attend.
Well, here's the way it's going to go down. I don't want to give away too many of the details, but we're going to go in there, we're going to chain the door shut, and we're not coming out until we get what we want. No, I think Paul's certainly going to go, and I think you're going to bring a staff with you. No? He says he can handle it alone. You're suggesting we send in an army? Yeah. Okay, we can talk offline about that. Anything further for the executive director? Okay. Moving along, regional administrator, Pat Kirkle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Starting with multispecies, we published a proposed rule in the Federal Register on September 7th, repromulgating one provision of the regulations, implementing the requirement for 100% observer coverage and the prohibition on releasing unobserved catch for midwater trawl vessels fishing for Atlantic herring in closed area one. The current provision, implemented through a final rule published last November, allows a midwater trawl vessel fishing in closed area one to release fish that can't be pumped from the net, and thus they remain in the net at the end of the pumping operations, and those fish are not sampled by the observer. The proposed rule requests comments on keeping the provision unchanged. There are options for modifying the provision and also an option to remove the provision. The comment period on that closes on October 7th. Effective September 7th, we reduced the fishing year 2010 Georges Bank Yellowtail tack to account for the 153 metric ton tack overage in fishing year 2009. This deduction is part of the U.S.-Canada resource understanding, and so is not related directly to the implementation of annual catch limits, but was revised through the annual catch limit requirements. The overharvest was a result of relatively high catch rates during a short period of time in April prior to the end of the last fishing year. Let's see. We published a proposed rule in the Federal Register on September 2nd requesting comments on potential additional exemptions to previously approved 2010 sector operations plans and contracts. The comment period on that closed on September 17th. However, we recently extended it to October 1st to allow the council an opportunity to comment. In addition to providing all the sectors the opportunity to select any of the 2010 exemptions that another sector may have selected, we're considering granting an exemption which would be functionally equivalent to the Gulf of Maine Haddock Sink Gillnet Pilot Program that was disapproved in Amendment 16, and that would be available to all sectors, as well as an exemption that would allow the discarding of unmarketable fish at sea. So again, the comment period on that has been extended to October 1st. The deadline for a fishing year 2011 sector operations plans was September 1st, with additional time allowed for sectors to submit their membership rosters. They had till September 10th. We received 19 operations plans that proposed 16 active sectors and 3 lease-only sectors, including 1 state-run permit bank. While 17 of the sectors proposed for fishing year 2011 were approved in Amendment 16 and operational for fishing year 2010, approval of 2 newly proposed sectors is contingent upon approval of Framework 45. There are currently 822 vessels enrolled in sectors for the fishing year 2011. That's 8% higher than the final number of vessels we had enrolled in sectors for 2010, and those vessels represent 98.76% of the ACLs. We published an advance notice of proposed rulemaking in the Federal Register on September 20th, requesting public comment on the reaffirmation of the current control date of March 30th, 2006 for the charter party fishery. The comment period on that closes on October 20th. On September 8th, the regional office hosted a meeting with representatives of Maine, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, and Rhode Island, along with council staff, to discuss progress towards implementing the 4 NOAA-funded state-operated permit banks. The focus of the meeting was to identify and discuss the current challenges to implementing and operating these permit banks, including procedural and regulatory requirements. The outcome of the meeting was a plan by the 4 state directors to propose the council consider modifying some of the sector requirements in the multi-species FMP in order to facilitate operation of the state permit banks. This will be discussed further under the Groundfish Committee report in the context of Framework 45. I have some additional information on the groundfish fishery to date. For the 2010 fishing year, but I will, if the council is interested, I'll provide that information during the groundfish discussion in the interest of time. For skates, that was discussed briefly, Amendment 3 became effective July 16th and included the rebuilding plan for overfished smooth skate, a new ACL framework and accountability measures, and new biological reference points. The final rule also included the final specifications for 2010 through 2011. And as you know, on October 31st, we published a notice in the Federal Register announcing that 80% of the skate wing tail had been harvested. Therefore, the skate wing possession limit was reduced from 5,000 pounds to 500 pounds. For the remainder of the 2010 fishing year through April 30, 2011, that was effective September 3rd. I think you do have the information that Andy's put together in your binder. I would just note that the fishery, as I mentioned, took effect July 16th, although the start of the fishing year was, of course, May 1st, and so the landings between May 1st and July 16th were attributed to the 2010 TAC. And so there was, they were operating under the higher trip limit during that period of time. And as a result, over 60% of the TAC was taken before we actually were able to implement the skate specifications for 2010. spiny dogfish on August 24th. We announced the period one quota had been harvested. Therefore, as of October 27th, the fishery was closed. That fishery will reopen on November 1st for the period two, under the period two quota. We have been looking at the issue of cost recovery in the Atlantic Sea Scallop fishery. The IFQ program requires that we collect fees for the costs of administering and enforcing the program. We looked at the possibility, since the first year is a partial year, March 1 through September 30, because the cost recovery is on an October 1 to September 30 cycle. So we looked at the possibility for the first year of waiving the costs. We thought everyone involved would appreciate that. And we determined that we did, in fact, have the flexibility to do that. So we're going to waive the costs for March 1 through September 30, 2010. And so the first time we'll implement the cost recovery program will actually be October 2011. In the scallop fishery. Let's see. We published, moving on to herring, we published a notice of availability for Amendment 4 to the Atlantic Herring Fishery Management Plan on August 12th. The comment period closes on October 12th. I think the council is familiar with what's included in Amendment 4, so we won't spend any more time on that. Also in herring, effective September 14th, vessels issued federal permits for Atlantic herring may not fish for, catch, possess, or land more than 2,000 pounds per trip in or from Area 1B through December 31st. As of September 22nd, catch from Area 1B is at 139% of the quota. There was no fishing activity in Area 1B in August, but in the 2 weeks preceding the closure, the catch was almost 1,500 metric tons, and then the following week, another 1,400 metric tons. In fact, we had three vessels report into the IVR system on September 7th with a total of over 1,400 metric tons, of 39% of the landings at the time. We were, based on that, unable to project enough in advance to prevent the overage at this point anyway, 39% or 40%, this is a problematic fishery in that regard for us in trying to do these projections. We're looking at what we can do in the future. I think Amendment 5 will help with the monitoring requirements, but in the interim, we're looking at what options we have for being better able to track this quota. I don't know yet. Anna's supposed to tell me later. Let's see. I'll skip that one in the interest of time. We published a notice in the moving on to protected resources, and in this case, Atlantic bluefin tuna. We published a notice in the Federal Register on September 21st responding to a 90-day petition to list Atlantic bluefin tuna under the Endangered Species Act. We found that the information in the petition and readily available in our files does present substantial information indicating that the petitioned action may be warranted. Consequently, we've initiated a status review for Atlantic bluefin tuna to assess the status of the species. The 90-day finding is the first step in the process, and we will be making a listing determination 12 months from the date on which the petition was received, within 12 months from the date on which the petition was received, which will be May 24th, 2011. Let's see. Just quickly, I think most of you are aware that there have been some questions about whether or not the Passamaquoddy tribe has aboriginal rights to fish in federal waters, and specifically they've been looking at whether or not they are They believe that they have rights to fish for both ground fish and scallops in federal waters. At this point, we have not been able to determine the basis for those claims, and so we've sent out two permit holder letters now alerting the industry and the public to that, and trying to make clear that, in fact, at this point, all federal requirements do apply to anybody fishing in the EEZ. And then we had, on September 17th, we had our biannual U.S.-Canada Steering Committee meeting. The majority of the meeting had to do with the recommendations for the three transboundary resources and the U.S.-Canada understanding. And I know we're going to talk about that under ground fish, so I won't spend any time on that. And I think the last thing, Paul mentioned that discussions continue on the possibility of having legislation to recognize the U.S.-Canada understanding as an international agreement under the Magnuson Act. I think there have been some additional discussions among members of Congress. We've been asked to provide some drafting assistance for legislation most recently, I think about 2 weeks ago. And so it's still alive, but I really couldn't give you any indication of what the possibility or potential for success might be in this Congress. And then finally, we are seeing some haddock bycatch in the herring fishery that we wanted to make the council aware of. And I have some data and information on that, but can save that for the herring discussion. How do you do? All right. That's it.
Thanks, Pat. Questions for Pat? Jimmy?
Yeah, just a comment on the U.S.-Canada understanding. It's my I've been told that that the legislation will be moved for unanimous consent in the Senate this week. So I think that maybe some resolution is on its way for that.
Mary Beth?
Just a couple things. The two items on herring exceeding the tack and then the haddock bycatch are of concern to us. And I think we can save it for our herring discussion. But just one other question on the IFQ scallop fishery. And I think I've asked some questions before. You're going to waive that first period. And then when you actually do assess the fishery, will you come up with like a formula that you'll publish in the Federal Register? I'm just not a little unclear how that process will go on.
No, it wouldn't be published. It's just an internal calculation of costs. And, of course, we'll do it in such a way so that it's it would be available if people were interested in seeing it. But there's no public comment type process on it.
Is it something that you could perhaps come back to the council and just show us, how it will function and work? People have just expressed concerns. I mean, a lot of fishermen receive pretty small allocations, and I think that they're just worried about what the cost to them will be, and I think just informationally for the council at some point.
Anything further for Pat? Paul Howard.
John just deemed the regulations for herring amendment for appropriate and necessary. And does that mean that, and I think there are still proposed rules, but the accountability measure for Area 1B, since there's an overage, we have our specs for herring for 2010, 11, and 12. So those specs are going to have to be addressed to account for the 1B overage. Is that your assumption?
Yeah, I believe that currently the way that it is written is that the 2010 overage would come off in 2012, but we didn't anticipate the overage, so we're looking at the proposed rule to make sure that it's clear in that regard.
Anything further for Pat? Okay, moving on. NOAA General Counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A new lawsuit was filed last week. This was filed by the Martha's Vineyards Duke County Fishermen's Association and Michael Flaherty, who's the vice president of the Massachusetts Striped Bass Association, against NOAA and ASMFC and each of the state fisheries directors, basically challenging, as the plaintiffs term it, the continuing unlawful management of river herring and shad along the East Coast. In a nutshell, the plaintiffs are suing the council and ASMFC to implement plans to address overfishing in the river herring and shad fisheries. With respect to the federal government, they're seeking an order that while this is an FMP is being developed, if the court orders it, that the agency implement emergency regulations to address overfishing and other conservation and management concerns, as well as to increase observer coverage and enhanced data collection in that fishery. There are three basic claims. One is that NOAA has failed to implement a river herring shad FMP in contravention of Magnuson Act requirements. They've failed to implement federal rules under the Atlantic Coastal Fishery Cooperative Management Act to complement state measures to protect river herring and shad, and also that the ASMFC and the state directors have failed to lawfully address conservation problems in this particular fishery. The second lawsuit I want to report on is in the Western Sea versus NOAA lawsuit, which was a challenge to Amendment 1, or one provision particularly, to Amendment 1 to the herring fishery that banned permit splitting. The court found against the government in favor of the plaintiffs with a holding that said that the permit splitting ban, at least as retroactively applied to the permits, was not rationally related to achieving optimum yield when there is no evidence or contention of current danger of overfishing. The court also found that maintaining landings well below optimum yield in one fishery as a means of preventing overfishery in other fisheries does not comport with National Standard 1. The court issued an order based on these findings that as to the retroactive application of the permit splitting ban as applied to the one remaining plaintiff at the time, that ban violated National Standard 1. The plaintiff in that case then moved to amend the order so that it would apply to two other plaintiff vessels that had been dropped out of the lawsuit, at least temporarily, and to order the agency to issue forthwith the permits to those three herring vessels. The court granted that motion to amend, and the government then filed a motion to amend the amended order, claiming that the court's order to grant the motions, to grant the permits without a remand back to the agency to consider whether granting the permits complied with other applicable law, even in light of the court's finding, was not allowed under established administrative law. And the court, without an opinion, denied our motion to amend the amended judgment. So the government now is considering whether to appeal this case. We made the argument in our motion to amend the amended order that it was entirely inappropriate for a federal court to order an executive agency to exercise its discretionary authority in a certain way without first remanding the the case or the situation back to the agency. We made the point that one of the three herring vessels that was ordered to be to get a permit, in fact, did not appear to meet eligibility requirements unrelated to the permit splitting ban, so that even if the permit splitting ban was taken out of the equation, that vessel did not meet some other eligibility requirements. I think one of them was that they had not been issued an open access permit in November of 2004, which is one of the prerequisites to getting a limited access herring permit. And I think the other problem mentioned in our motion was that there may have not been corroborating evidence to establish that even using the split-off permit history, that there was dealer corroboration of those landings. So the government is considering appealing both on the motion, this procedural or remedy motion that or order that required us to issue the permits, as well possibly on the merits of the finding that the permit splitting ban did not comport with National Standard 1. An update to our Amendment 16 lawsuits. As I've reported before, we have three separate lawsuits, two filed by fishing industry representatives, one from New Jersey, filed originally in the New Jersey Federal District Court, and then several plaintiffs, including the cities of New Bedford and Gloucester, which have been added. Gloucester has actually been added to the lawsuit since my last report, which was filed in the Boston Federal District Court. There was also a challenge to Amendment 16 brought by Oceana, an environmental group, in the D.C. Circuit Court. The two fishermen plaintiff cases have now been combined into the Boston Federal District Court so that those two challenges will be considered at the same time by the same judge. The Oceana lawsuit, which was filed in the D.C. District Court, there's a pending motion by the government to transfer that case to the same judge that's now considering the two fishing industry brought cases. And that the judge has yet to rule on that motion. We've also gotten a schedule for litigation for the Boston Federal District portion of the Amendment 16 cases. The court established September 23rd as a date that the federal government must file its opposition to a motion brought by New Bedford requesting further discovery. In particular, the New Bedford plaintiff requested that depositions be allowed for Dr. Lubchenco, Patricia Kirkle, Monica Medina, John Pappalardo, and Sally McGee of the council. The federal government vigorously opposed this motion. It's highly unusual to allow any additional discovery, and particularly to unusual to allow for depositions in an administrative record case. The normal procedure is that we provide the written record for the case, which we have done, and the court is decided on that record and not based on any other additional discovery. So the court had given us till September 23rd to file an opposition brief to that motion, which we did. And so we're awaiting further consideration by the court on that motion. The court also established the date of October 1st for any additional motions to supplement the administrative record by any of the plaintiffs. October 13th was established as the date that the plaintiffs must file their motion for summary judgment, which is basically their brief supporting why they think Amendment 16 was unlawful. The federal government has until December 12th, and there will be two separate motions for summary judgment filed, one by the Massachusetts plaintiff and one plaintiffs, and one by the New Jersey plaintiff that is now combined in the Boston Federal District Court. And the government has until December 12th to respond to those motions for summary judgment. The plaintiffs have until January 10th to oppose the government's motions for summary judgment. The federal government has until January 27th to reply to those opposition motions, and the court has set February 9th as the date for the oral hearing on the lawsuit. Now, all of those dates are subject to change depending on parties' requests to extend deadlines or possibly the need for the judge to resolve motions on discovery issues. Just to bring you up to date on Amendment 11, the challenge to Amendment 11, the Scallop Amendment 11, I think I reported last time that the federal defendants won on all counts on that challenge to the limited access general category amendment. The plaintiff in that lawsuit has since filed an appeal and filed the motion and brief in support of their appeal of the judge's decision. The federal government filed its opposition brief in that appeal on September 20th. And so each party will have an opportunity to reply to the other party's brief, and then we will wait the outcome of this by the Court of Appeals. I think it's the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. In another lawsuit, I can't remember if I reported on this last time or not, the Midcoast versus NIMS lawsuit. This was a lawsuit challenging our denial of a petition for rulemaking to require 100% observer coverage in the herring fishery, a motion to close down the groundfish to closed areas to herring fishing. This was, I think, originally done in 2007 or 2008. The court, this case was assigned to a magistrate, which is like an assistant judge that makes a preliminary finding for the main judge in the case. The magistrate denied both motions for summary judgment on behalf of plaintiff and defendants in that case, and recommended a remand. Back to the agency to further justify or consider the data that was used to deny the petition for rulemaking, as well as any concurrent data. Parties in a case where a magistrate makes a recommendation have, I believe it's 30 days to object to the magistrate's recommendation to the main judge in the case. This finding came down, I believe, in July of this past summer, and we've gotten a couple of extensions to filing the deadline for filing our objection to the magistrate's finding based on an agreement with the plaintiffs in that lawsuit. And most recently, we got an extension to object to that magistrate's recommendation until October 15th so that the parties can see what happens at the council meeting in connection with Amendment 5, whether that might address the plaintiff's concerns, whether there's any need to pursue further litigation in that lawsuit. And finally, just a follow-up to Pat's description of the publication of a Federal Register notice asking for comments on repromulgating the requirement to have 100% observer coverage in closed area 1 on midwater trawl herring vessels. That repromulgation came out of an agreement with plaintiffs in the Taylor v. Lott case. In that case, the plaintiffs had sued the agency for promulgating the exemption to the 100% or exemption to requiring a net to be brought on board for observation in cases where there were small amounts of fish left in the net after pumping operations were completed. That provision was added in the final rule and was never specifically proposed in a proposed rule. The plaintiffs had claimed that violated Administrative Procedure Act because it didn't allow proper comment on that additional exemption that was added in the final rule. We agreed to go ahead and repromulgate that portion of the rule in order to get additional comments to do one of the three options that Pat described, which was to leave the exemption in place, to replace it with a requirement that all nets be brought on board after pumping operations, or to allow the discretion of the captain to either raise the net out of the water for visual observation or bring the net on board. So we will pursue our rulemaking authority in that case based on comments. And that concludes my presentation, Mr. Chair.
All right, we can have time for a couple of brief questions for Gene. I had one. The herring permit splitting case, what's the possibility that we're looking at people coming out of the woodwork claiming they should get issued a permit?
I think our preliminary analysis showed that there's just a handful of vessels that would fit in the same circumstances as the plaintiffs in that case. So I don't think that's a big possibility. You know, we'd have to wait and see if there are vessels that may not have applied in the first place or something.
Okay. Brief questions for Gene? Seeing none, thank you, Gene. Moving right on to Northeast Fisheries Science Center. Is it Nancy or Jim?
Jim,
you're up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the assessments, the assessment that was done in June of 2010 was SARC 50. That was a peer-reviewed assessment of sea scallops, monkfish, and pollock. And I'll be reporting to you on that tomorrow morning. And my PowerPoint presentation is in your briefing book behind tab one. The Science Center also did, within the TRAC process, which is our joint assessments with Canada, between January and July, there were track assessments of dogfish, mackerel, Eastern Georges Bank cod, Eastern Georges Bank haddock, and Georges Bank yellowtail flounder. The Science Center also completed assessment updates for bluefish, black sea bass, scup, fluke, butterfish, and dogfish, all between April and September of this year. We are planning for the next SARC, which will be SARC 51. It's going to occur the last week of November in Woods Hole. And the stocks on for peer review at that time will be Lalago squid, two stocks of silver hake, two stocks of red hake, and offshore hake. Then looking ahead to SARC 52, which will be the week of June the 6th, in 2011, the three winter flounder stocks are all on the agenda for that SARC. And they were all placed together following the recommendation of the GARM reviewers that all three stocks be reviewed at the same time. Then there will also be work done next spring and summer by the center to support the multi-species Amendment 16, there are analyses that need to be done to review the information on catches and surveys to support the setting of biennial ACLs. There will also be, again, track meetings next spring for the Georges Bank stocks, and those will be June the 20th to the 24th. And next year, in addition to doing the annual SBRM report, it'll be time for the three-year report, which is much more expansive. Then I'll just mention a couple of upcoming SARCs beyond that. In December of 2011, black sea bass and Gulf of Maine cod are scheduled. And for June of 2012, which will be SARC 54, southern New England yellowtail flounder and herring are both on the agenda. Then a few updates on surveys that have taken place. The sea scallop dredge survey was completed on July the 2nd, and the data were available in August for PDT work. The northern shrimp survey was completed on August the 7th, and all the data were made available by early September. Both of the vessels that are used by the Northeast Fisheries Science Center, the Delaware II and the Henry Bigelow, we're both down in the Gulf this summer and through August, but both have returned and are now conducting their survey work out of for our Northeast region. And I have a few more details about what they were doing that down there, but I won't go into them unless somebody wants to talk to me during the break. The autumn multi-species bottom trawl survey, the first leg was completed as of September the 24th with 126 bottom stations, and four more survey legs are scheduled through November the 18th. And this is all done with the Henry Bigelow. Finally, the herring acoustic survey. The first leg of the survey was completed on the Delaware 2. And that completes my report. I'd be happy to answer any questions, or if Nancy would like to add anything as well. Thank you.
In the interest of time, anything pressing for Dr. Weinberg? Thanks, Jim. We look forward to your report tomorrow morning. Okay, moving right along. Mid-Atlantic Fishery Management Council liaisons.
Frank? Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Mid met in mid-August in Philadelphia. They voted to approve the omnibus amendment for submission. This amends six of their plans, which institutes the ACLs and AMs, and also establishes a policy to provide guidance on the annual catch limits with regard to the risk of overfishing. They also met to set the specs for summer flounder, scup, black sea bass, and bluefish. Summer flounder, the TAL, is going up approximately 7 million pounds. For scup, looks like about a 6 million pound increase. Black sea bass, I believe, was status quo, and bluefish was about a 2 million pound decrease. They held the election of officers. Rick Robbins and Lee Anderson were reelected to chair and vice chair, so congratulations. Finally, the Squid Mackerel Butterfish Committee met to review the scoping comments on Amendment 14. The committee approved river herring and shad monitoring and incidental catch goals for the amendment. And that's basically about any questions.
Rick, did you want to add anything?
Just a few things quickly, Mr. Chairman. I did already indicate that we're moving forward with trying to formalize some sort of relationship with the regional planning body on the governance issue. But a couple points. We did move forward, as Frank indicated, with Amendment 14 on addressing Alizine bycatch, and obviously that's going to be a significant issue, I think, jointly between our councils as we consider the overlap between the mackerel fishery and the herring fishery and some of the common issues there. We do have an October 6th meeting of that committee that will be a non-decisional informational meeting that will include analyses of bycatch and an update on river herring information, et cetera, but that will be October 6th in Philadelphia. We took a couple of other actions as a council. We voted to develop an ecosystem subcommittee of our SSC, and we'll be considering draft terms of reference at our upcoming council meeting, where we would be asking the SSC through that subcommittee to develop scientific advice that would allow and enable the council to consider ecosystem structure and function in its quota setting process and in its FMPs for near-term advice, and also some longer-term advice about how we might eventually develop a regional ecosystem fishery management plan. So we'll be considering those terms of reference at our next meeting. We're also developing an AP fishery performance report. That would be a measure that would more effectively incorporate our advisory panels in a structured way into our decision-making process. We're working with a social scientist on the SSC to do that, to format the information that the SSC would benefit from, to try to fill in some of the blanks. We think this would really help in data-poor situations, but I don't think the benefits would be limited to that. The AP has a perspective that we want to try to incorporate more fully in the decision-making process, so we're trying to develop that right now. Our next meeting is October 12th through 14th in Cape May, and we'll be setting spiny dogfish specifications there. We're also moving forward with a visioning project. We've established a committee. We'll be doing more to reach out to the ASMFC on that issue as well for the joint plans, and that that project would propose to develop a comprehensive stakeholder-informed vision of the council's managed fisheries. We recognize that we can do more, I think, to incorporate stakeholder input, and we're proposing to do some comprehensive surveying and outreach with our stakeholders to do that, and then possibly incorporate that in a strategic plan or in an FMP by FMP review of goals and objectives for our managed fisheries. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions concerning either Frank or Rick's report? Rick, I look forward to taking a look at your AP performance review because I'm keenly interested in applying that up here, or at least a version of it.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chairman, and as soon as that's fleshed out with the input from our SSC, I plan to forward that to you.
Look forward to that. Okay, moving on, U.S. Coast Guard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before I start, and I understand I'm under time constraints here, Lieutenant Bernat spent his summer in the Gulf of Mexico cleaning up the Deepwater Horizon spill, and he is back, so I'd like to publicly commend him for his outstanding service down there, and welcome back. We're happy to have you back, Tim. The presentation? There we go. There we go. Okay, great. Briefly, observed compliance rate is up for the year. The numbers are on the screen, so I won't repeat them. Two of the violations were issued to the fishing vessel claiming to fish under the Passamaquoddy tribal rights, as Pat mentioned earlier. We were able to find and issue those violations based on some outstanding investigative work from our partners in NOAA Office of Law Enforcement. So I'd like to commend them for their work in that case, just say that they were able to allow us to get on board there and stabilize that situation and prevent some significant harm to the resource if that situation had gone unchecked. Is this? Can you just go to the next slide? Okay. The safety numbers are there, our observed compliance rate is increased, and it was a very busy SAR season, 140 lives saved since June 1st. Three lives were lost, with 67 reported casualties and three commercial fishing vessel terminations. And the Patriot Marine Casualty Investigation was released 2 weeks ago. Next slide, please. I'd like to briefly follow up on my report in June to the council discussed the breakdowns of the sea scallop and multi-species fleets. Next slide. As you may recall, in June I presented some comparisons of the scallop and multi-species fleets, the age and size segments with data on fishing vessel casualties. And the casualties are listed there in the slide. Next slide. These are the conclusions from that report. Essentially, there was some correlation between segments of the scallop fleet and casualties, and there were some areas where segments of the multi-species fleet showed some disproportionate amount of casualties. Next slide. So what we did was we got Bill Semrau's shop, again, Office of Law Enforcement, to provide us with some VMS data on how much fishing had occurred, and he was able to, through some exhaustive work, break down the VMS data by fleet and by size and by vessel age. By having that information available, we were able to compare fishing activity with casualties and obtain a casualty rate, which is a much more useful analytical tool and allows us to make some comparisons across segments and across FMPs. Next slide. So, next slide. So these are the numbers for the scallop fleet age, and really the rightmost column is the reported casualty rate. As you can see, it's simply the casualty rate per 100,000 hours of fishing. The hours of fishing are on the left side, and this is the scallop fleet age breakdown. And as you can see, generally the scallop fleet casualty rate increases as the age of the vessels increase, although not perfectly. As you can see, the older vessels have a slightly lower casualty rate. Next slide. For the scallop fleet size, one number jumps off the page, and that is for the scallop vessels that are 30 to 39 feet in length. And while we weren't able to break down our casualties by limited access and general category, but because our Coast Guard database is limited, the VMS broke it down by limited access and general category. And all the hours for the 30 to 39 foot segment of the fleet were general category vessels. And the vast majority of the 40 to 49 foot segment of the fleet was also general category vessels. Next slide. For the multi-species fleet, there's a general core rise in the casualty rate as the age groups get older. Next slide. And for the multi-species fleet size, fairly flat numbers, but there's the 70 to 79 foot segment appears to have a bit of a higher, an elevated casualty rate. So another point for further analysis. Next slide. And these are my conclusions. General increase with age, no-brainer. Significantly increased casualty rate with the 30 to 39-foot scallop vessels, and an elevated casualty rate with the 70 to 79-foot scallop vessels. And the multi-species fleet appears to have a generally higher casualty rate than the scallop fleet. And just a point, it would be, be nice to incorporate this in a systematic analysis, but I would just call a word of caution. This is a heavy, heavy lift, both for Bill Semrau's staff and for my staff. It is not sustainable, but I felt it was necessary to follow up on this report. And we'll use this as moving forward. We'll do the best we can with this type of analyses. And again, the bottom line of all this, loss of stability and man overboard continue to be leading causes for fatalities. That concludes my report. I know that's a lot of numbers, Mr. Chair. Karen has the information, and I'm happy to discuss offline or if we want to discuss later on if there's time in the agenda.
Thanks, Pete. Rodney.
Yeah. Thank you, Captain DeCullen. Did you break that out by gear type? Could you break that out by gear type? I know you got Fisher's type.
I don't have that. I can't break it down by that data, not with our database.
Captain Howard.
Just real quick, Pete, when you've got 16 point something casualties for 100,000 hours, 100,000 hours is like 4,000 days, and 4,000 days is like 9 years, so it's like almost two casualties per year, almost. That's about the scale we're looking at.
Anything further? Thanks, Pete. Okay, enforcement, VMS.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. For those that don't know me, Timothy Donovan, Andy Cohen has stepped down as a special agent in charge for the Northeast Enforcement Division, and currently I'll be acting in his place until we get a permanent replacement. Start off with the OIG report came out last week, and I'll address that today as far as my report's concerned. OLE is fully committed to addressing all corrective actions that will be identified. Fair and effective enforcement is still essential to our ability to rebuild and protect the public's fisheries and other natural resources. Secretary Locke was in town, and he made some announcements last week as well as yesterday. Key in that announcement was the appointment of Judge Swartwood as a special master to review the complaints identified in the IG report. Judge Swartwood is coming from currently the chairman of the Mass State Ethics Commission and the former chief magistrate, and we look forward to working with him to reform and improve our operations. NOAA has continually addressed the IG's recommendations from early reports, including transferring the oversight of our asset forfeiture fund, as well as drafting new policies that are currently going into place very soon. Alan Reisenhoover, director of the NOAA's Office of Sustainable Fisheries, continues to serve as the acting director until that position is filled as well. Hiring of the Benjamin Friedman as the new Assistant General Counsel for Enforcement and Litigation. We are wrapping up our workforce analysis to determine the appropriate mix of criminal investigators and civil enforcement officers. Just yesterday, we advertised positions for 8 uniformed enforcement officers for the Northeast. We're continuing to review and revise our law enforcement operations manual, as well as General Counsel is doing similar with their program. We're developing a communications plan to provide greater outreach to fishermen and fishing communities and stakeholders. This will probably be one of the changes that we see with the asset forfeiture funding, as I understood from Secretary Locke's office. One of those activities was August 3rd, where we held the National Enforcement Summit down in D.C. And we're still working on the results after action report from that committee. Maybe by the next council meeting, I'll have more detail on that after action. OLE is developing a process to set enforcement priorities at the national and regional level, and that will be one of our key projects as the fiscal year kicks off. On the general counsel side, there's been a requirement now for a high-level legal review for all the charging and settlement decisions, and they are developing a new penalty policy. Right now, all I can say is we're going to continue doing the job to the best of our capability, and we look forward to any improvements, and we'll be working with yourself and the industry as we move forward. Sir.
Thanks, Tim. Good luck. BMS.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Council members. I'm Bill Semro, Northeast VMS Program Manager. The Northeast VMS team is currently monitoring 1,148 vessels. This represents a reduction of 164 vessels since my report to you back in June. Some of that is probably related to cleanup of our VMS registration database. And it also represents a steady decline in the VMS population since the spring of 2007, when the population was near 1,600. Our VMS database is automatically updated with the current Northeast multi-species sector and common pool membership. And we're showing that there are 430 sector vessels and 164 common pool vessels that are actively registered with an installed VMS, a reduction of 9 and 21 vessels respectively since June. Moving on, there was a recent change in the VMS program management at headquarters. Logan Gregory, whose current position is Assistant Special Agent in Charge for OLE's Field Office, District 4 in Newport News, has been detailed to headquarters by Alan Reisenhoover to serve as the acting National VMS and IT Program Manager. Last month, the 5 regional VMS program managers, myself included, and the respective special agents in charge met in Seattle for 2 days to brief Alan on our local VMS programs. Given the change in VMS leadership over the past several months, the purpose was to bring Alan up to speed on both the immediate and long-term issues of concern. And it was recognized that our goal was a cohesive and a solid national program that also allows flexibility at the regional level. I found it encouraging at a high level that there was recognition for regional flexibility in those VMS applications being used increasingly for both compliance monitoring and data collection. I'm also encouraged by having the services of a new programmer starting October 4th. Philip Corcoran has been hired as a contract employee to work in Gloucester on the VMS team to provide local programming support, including the development and maintenance of scripts and reports, data mining, and the documentation of our processes. Another positive development is the drafting of an interconnection security agreement between the Northeast Science Center and OLE for VMS database read-only access. The agreement had been previously signed by the Science Center, and I'm told that the document has been recently signed by Alan Reisenhoover, the acting director. So that's a positive development where the Science Center can access all the database tables available in VMS. Finally, New York State Division of Marine Resources is implementing a VMS program for their 22 limited entry surf clam permit holders, effective January 1, 2011. Their program is modeled after the federal program. Amendment 1 to their FMP requires a declaration program and 15-minute position reporting. Of the 22 vessels, 7 have VMS required by their federal permits. For these 7 vessels, New York's desire is to develop a separate VMS software application from the NIMS software, but have it run on the existing VMS hardware. OLE and New York State are working together to find solutions to the issues of concern to both parties. And that concludes my report. Thank you.
Enforcement or VMS questions? Comments? Go to the audience. You have to come up to the table. And you have to introduce yourself on mic, sorry.
Howdy, Emery from Chatham. Has the Inspector General ordered an investigation or an audit at a minimum of the previous expenditures out of the fund created by all the fines with regard to travel and other questionable expenditures? If not, will that information be available under the Right to Know Act?
Currently, the IG's office, they did conduct an audit, hired a contractor to conduct an audit for the asset forfeiture fund, and I think that was one of the our final recommendations they're working off with the Secretary's office as far as with the new policies and what is the result of the review on the asset forfeiture. If there's additional information that's not provided in those reports, then the Freedom of Information Act would kick in place.
Anything further under enforcement and VMS? Thanks, Tim.
Thank you, sir.
Anything the council needs to know about Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission? Anything at all? Anyone want to report out anything? Vince?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. I know you're running on time, so I'll be brief. Thanks to my good friend, Captain Howard, the summary of our August summer meeting is in your briefing materials, and I'd note that covers a special meeting that the Lobster Board held in July in Providence, Rhode Island, regarding the Southern New England situation, as well as discussions at our August meeting. And bottom line there is we have advice from our technical committee about what to do, and the board wants to get that advice peer-reviewed, and they're working on the terms of reference for that. There's also a white paper was presented regarding state-by-state allocation of spiny dogfish. We thought perhaps the board was going to take action on that in August, but instead they said the issues need a bit more polishing. But I think the signal is there is interest in moving towards, at the commission level, state-by-state quotas for spiny dogfish. And the rest of the accomplishments of the summer meeting are highlighted in the press releases in the back of the report, and council members can read all about it there. In addition, Mr. Chairman, our next meeting is our annual meeting. It's November 7 through the 11th. It's in Charleston, Rhode Island, Charleston, South Carolina, at the Francis Marion Hotel. Two items there that may be of particular interest is I suspect there'll be a discussion on the increase in SCUP quota and perhaps a revision of the current allocation between the winter and the summer season, as well as sector allocations between recreational and commercial. There's interest in revisiting that by some members of the board. And we'll also be taking final action on Atlantic striped bass proposal to adjust the commercial quota upwards. We've held the public hearings on that, and I know that's an item of high interest. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman. I'll be here today and tomorrow. Thanks for the hospitality, and it's nice to be here.
Thanks, Vince. Anything further? Okay, here's what I'm going to propose. There are no EFP applications behind tab 14 that the comment period is still open under. The experiments that were EFP applications that were filed are contained behind tab 14. Just ask you to review those on your own. If you want to discuss them with the full council or with me or anyone on staff, feel free to do that offline. We're going to call for a break here, and when we come back, we'll do the open period, dogfish, and we'll probably break for lunch before hearing. We'll see where we are on the clock. But we'll take a 10-minute break now and come back for public comment period.